Has the Evangelical Church of America become the immoral majority? That's what my guest today says.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on The Line of Fire today, 866-348-7884. I was excited to learn, just shortly before the show today, that I am going to be joined by author Ben Howe. His book, hot off the press and best-selling immediately, The Immoral Majority, Why Evangelicals Chose Political Power Over Christian Values. He will be joining me at the bottom of the hour. So we're going to have a very interesting conversation, and I think it's going to be edifying, helpful, challenging. But first, we've got a bunch of other issues to discuss, and I may have time to take some questions. 866-348-7884. That's 866-348-7884 is the number to call. Okay. President Trump and Israel. I just typed in the words Trump and Jews. Can't be more broad than that. And of course, a flood of headlines. Here's on Vox. Donald Trump, quote, King of Israel and the fragile state of American Jewry. New York Times, Trump again accuses American Jews of disloyalty. 2 hours ago. 23 minutes ago, how Fox is defending Trump's allegation that Jewish voters are showing great disloyalty. BBC News, Trump accuses Jewish Democrats of great disloyalty. I mean, this is everywhere. AlJazeera.com, yes, a Middle East Arabic-based and now English-speaking as well. Jews tweet disloyal to Trump after Trump calls them disloyal. Okay, what in the world is going on? President Trump and Israel obviously taking flack for Trump discouraging Israel from letting Representatives Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib come into Israel last week, saying no to that, and then Israel's decision in that. So a lot of flack against the president, a lot of flack against Israel, and Trump is calling out Democrats, calling out American Jews who overwhelmingly vote Democrat. Let's just broad figures. Say in the last several election cycles, probably roughly speaking, American Jews have voted 80% Democrat. African Americans have voted 90% Democrats. You've got two large groups of people or influential groups of people who are voting very heavily Democrat, and then, of course, white evangelicals overwhelmingly Republican, all right, 81% Republican in the last election. So you've got these demographics where different groups lean heavily in one direction or another. And a lot of evangelical Christians can't understand the votes of American Jews. And they think, why are you voting like this? The Republican Party is much more Israel-friendly and much more pro-Israel than the Democrat Party. And we see now some real cracks, some real fissures, some real holes in the dam in terms of Democrats standing with Israel. We know a few years back in the Democrat Party platform, there was an attempt to remove reference to Jerusalem, reference to God. I mean, it's clear which direction this was going in the Republican platform, pro-God, pro-Israel, pro-family, very different. So a lot of evangelical Christians look at the Jewish people and say, in America, why do you vote so overwhelmingly Democrat? And the Republican Party is much more a loyal friend, a faithful friend to Israel and standing with Israel. And Bush and then Trump have been much better friends of Israel than Obama was. And how can you vote the way you vote? And a lot of American Jews turn around and say, first, the Democrat Party reflects our values. The vast majority of American Jews are very liberal. And they are on the opposite side of social justice issues as compared to evangelicals, all right? Both white and black evangelicals and Hispanic evangelicals. They're pro-abortion. you know, women's right to choose. They're pro-homosexual rights. Hey, it's a persecuted minority, or they're discriminated against. They see things through very, very different eyes. And those values are important to them. For some, it's a religious thing. This is a prophetic tradition of standing with the oppressed and the beaten down and so on, and standing for women and minorities. And then it somehow becomes pro-abortion, pro-LGBT activism. And some of it's just plain worldly. It's American Jews, some carnal worldly like anybody else, and having clout and influence and using it in wrong ways. But most American Jews do not have the same view of the modern state of Israel evangelical Christians do. They believe in the modern state of Israel. They are pro-Israel, especially after the Holocaust. They believe Israel should have a homeland. But because they are not religious Jews, because they are not biblically based in their faith, they are not looking at this so much as fulfillment of prophecy. They are not saying God brought the Jewish people back to the land, and it's by divine right that the Jewish people are back in the land. And many leaning left have great sympathies with the Palestinians, and there should be sympathies for anyone that's being treated unjustly, and Israel's far from perfect. We understand that. And I'm saying that as an evangelical, as a Messianic Jew. But the point of the matter is this, that evangelical Christians will stand with Israel much more than your average American Jew. So Donald Trump looks at this. It's outrageous he's being called anti-Semitic for saying this about Jewish people. Again, his daughter converted to Judaism. His son-in-law is an Orthodox Jew, a modern Orthodox. His grandkids are therefore Jewish, under Jewish law. And even in my most passionate Trump-opposing days during the primaries, I wrote an article saying I didn't believe he was an anti-Semite. And obviously he has stood with Israel in many ways and done significant things for Israel and moved the embassy to Jerusalem and recognized the Golan Heights and pushed back against the Iran deal. In many ways proved himself to be a real friend of Israel and the Jewish people. So I don't think it was anti-Semitic for him to say what he said. But again, to me, when President Trump says these kinds of things, like Jews who don't vote for him are either extremely ignorant or disloyal, obviously disloyal to Israel, all that does is create more problems. It is one of those things with the president of a few steps forward and then a few steps backward, that you inflame so much passionate, tense emotion and hatred, and you can hardly even look at the issues. And in my view, you end up polarizing more than rallying people behind a common cause. You end up polarizing, but unnecessarily. Listen, I'm happy, if it pleases God, to be the most polarizing person on the planet or in my neighborhood, if by following Jesus and holding to biblical principles, I'm polarizing. So be it. You be a polarizing figure. If that's what loving God, loving your neighbor means, walking in obedience to the truth, so be it. But there's a polarizing that is unnecessary. That's what I believe is happening here. Okay. So from President Trump's perspective, here's what he's thinking. I'm standing with Israel. I'm a friend of Israel. I'm pushing back against these Islamic terroristic existential threats against Israel and the Jewish people. And Prime Minister Netanyahu and I are in lockstep in so many of the things we're standing together on, that for a Jewish person to not be pro-Trump, you either have to be disloyal to Israel or extremely ignorant. Obviously, it's an insult. He's had worse insults than that, okay? But Jewish people would look at that thing, have you lost your mind? First, we're not blindly loyal to Israel, they'd say. Secondly, we oppose all these policies of yours, and I'm sure they have different views on immigration than Trump, etc. So to them, it's just a slam and an insult. They're saying, we don't like you. Don't call us ignorant, and don't think that we're disloyal to Israel. We don't like you. Well, Trump then responds and says basically he's super popular in Israel, and he's looked at as, quote, the king of Israel. That's how people think of him, king of Israel, and second coming of God. Now, when I was in Israel a couple of times since Trump's been president, I was struck by the pro-Trump sentiment and the pro-Trump signs. Now, I had one cab driver who was totally anti-Trump, and he said, two people voted for Donald Trump. I said, who's that? I think he said his daughter and Putin. And I said, where'd you get that from? He goes, I listened to the news also. But everywhere else I turned, I didn't bring it up. People brought up Trump to me. They wanted to talk about Trump, make America great, make Israel great. They thought Trump was terrific. And they had very negative feelings on Obama. They had better feelings about Bush. Just talking about man on the street type of things. And I think that's what surveys will bear out. And Israelis, in terms of a voting bloc on social issues, they are very liberal, okay? But on the issues of security and things like that, they tend to be very conservative because what they've lived with. So those issues are of greater importance to them in Israel than to your average American Jew. But I don't think it helps the cause for President Trump to say, yeah, he's looked at as the king of Israel and the second coming of God. What does that help? Who does that enlist in your cause? How does that advance what you're trying to do? So I would say, yes, President Trump, you've been an amazing friend of Israel. Yes, you've had the guts to do what no one has done. Bill Clinton didn't move the embassy. George W. Bush didn't move the embassy. Barack Obama didn't move the embassy. Donald Trump moved the embassy. And President Trump, you've pushed back against the disastrous Iran deal. And finally, officially recognize Golan Heights. And you're not afraid to talk about radical Islam. You've been a friend of Israel. You've been a friend of Prime Minister Netanyahu. I appreciate all that. But don't further alienate American Jews by insulting them. Why not appeal? Why not say, look, what can I do to get your trust? I know we don't see eye to eye on a lot of things. But I'm a friend of Israel. I'm a friend of the Jewish people. There's Jewish blood right here in my own family now. So let's stand together for the common good. And you're not going to encourage and get the support and backing of evangelicals by saying, yeah, they look at me as like the king of Israel and second coming of God. Those are the unfortunate things that the president takes a few steps forward, then shoots himself in the foot. So President Trump, we're praying for you to continue to stand to be a friend of Israel and a friend of the church, but that God would give you a wisdom that would be mind-blowing and that would be for the good of the nation and the world. We'll be right back.
Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, bottom of the hour, so a little over 10 minutes from now, I'll be joined by author Ben Howe, The Immoral Majority, Why Evangelicals Chose Political Power Over Christian Values. I haven't finished reading the book. I actually bought an e-copy before we got it from the publisher to have Ben on the show. So that's how much I was interested in the subject. So much of what I've read so far, like I agree, and other parts I disagree. So I'm really looking forward to having this important discussion with Ben. Hey, if you live anywhere near Austin, Texas, maybe I should mention this in the second half of the broadcast that blankets that part of the nation, the Dallas-Fort Worth and Austin. Anyway, if you live anywhere near Austin, Texas, I'm going to be ministering there this Sunday morning only, Sunday morning. So check the itinerary at AskDrBrown.org. And then next weekend, there's an amazing Together for Israel conference being held in Pensacola, Florida. All right. It starts, I believe, August 30th, Friday night. Then I'll be speaking Saturday, day and night. Continues into Sunday. Registration is free, but you are requested to sign up. So go to my website, AskDrBrown.org, click on itinerary, and then just click on that conference Together for Israel. I'd love to see you there. And then I'm just going to be standing down in Pensacola because a couple of days after that is a massive Light the Fire Again conference with Bay Center, which seats, I think, 10,000, over 20,000 registered, something like that. So should be an incredible time as we cry out to God for a fresh wave of revival. 866-34-TRUTH is the number to call. And with that, we're going to go to the phones. Bob in Tennessee, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, thank you, Dr. Brown. I'm going to talk fast because I got a lot to say. I don't like the Calvinism's limited atonement for a lot of reasons. I believe in the sovereignty of God, which is Ephesians 3, 4, and 5, and other verses. But there's also the free will of man, Romans 10, 13, and so forth. You can find probably the same amount of verses on each side. I believe both are true, even though someone would say that's an oxymoron. There's no oxymorons with God. But James White would call that Molinism, which I don't know what you want to call it. My question is this. How would a Calvinist who believes in limited atonement answer 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 9, when
yep.
Peter is saying two reasons why why Jesus hadn't come back? Number one, he doesn't count time as we do. Number two, he's waiting each day for more people to come to him. Now, if it's already been settled, why? Can you explain that to me?
Yes, sir. Thank you. Great questions. We'll put aside the Molinism issue totally, but for those who don't follow Bob's question, Calvinists believe in what's called limited atonement or definite atonement, meaning that Jesus did not die to make salvation possible for the whole world, but rather died specifically to save those that the Father set his love on, and those that Jesus died for, he purchased their salvation, and they will be saved, and they will forever serve him. What I hold to is that Jesus died on the cross to make salvation possible for all men so God could declare to the world, all your sins are paid for, all right, an extraordinary act of God's love, and to infallibly secure the salvation of those who put their trust in Jesus. So it's in the Calvinistic scheme, the L in the word tulip, limited atonement. So how do Calvinists respond to 2 Peter 3:9? Now, when I was a Calvinist, 77 to 82, this was my response, and this is a common Calvinist response. So it says in 2 Peter 3:9, the Lord is not slack toward us, as some men count slackness, but is long-suffering. So what does it say in the text? He is long-suffering toward us, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. So I agree with you, Bob, that the most natural way to read that is that God is extending an opportunity to all to come to repentance and hence waiting before he returns. The Calvinist response would be this. No, God is long-suffering toward us. Who? The elect. Waiting for all of us to repent. So when the full number of the elect comes in, then Jesus will return. That would be the Calvinist response. Just like the Calvinist response to 1 Timothy 2, 1 through 4, that we're to pray for kings, rulers, authorities, etc., for it's God's will that all be saved. Calvinists would say that means all classes, kings, rulers, but just all kinds of people. And when I say when you put all the evidence together, it indicates God's desire, his love is for every human being on the planet to be saved, and he will save those who put their trust in his son. So whether you'd like the response or not, that would be the Calvinist answer to that. He's long-suffering toward us, not willing that any of us should perish, but waiting until all of us come to repentance. That's how a Calvinist would read it. So you can chew on that. Obviously, it will not satisfy you where you're coming from, but that would be the answer, okay?
Would you say that both are true, the sovereignty of God and the free will of man, in some way that we cannot as finite human beings understand that, but both are actually taught in the scriptures? Because they plainly are.
Yeah. So here's, again, the question is, what do we mean by the sovereignty of God, and what do we mean by the free will of man? In other words, do we believe that God does as he chooses, and that God sits and rules and reigns as king on his throne, and that he's not trying and wishing and hoping, but he's carrying out his plan? On the one hand, well, at the same time, he allows human beings to make choices which are often contrary to his will and contrary to what he's laid out for us. But in his sovereignty, he said, I am giving you choices. He chose to give us choices. Yeah, I believe that. And I believe sometimes it does transcend what we can understand. Now, I don't believe in sovereignty of God the way a Calvinist would, that basically God preordains everything that happens. And I don't believe in the free will of man the way worldly people would, that we can make any choices freely because we're still bound by sin. We can't save ourselves. But yeah, Bob, I believe that the two go hand in hand and that there is some mystery, just like understanding God's eternal nature or triunity. These are transcendent truths. There's an interesting statement in an early Jewish document called Pirkei Avot, about a couple hundred years after the time of Jesus. And it says, Hakol Tzafui, V'harishut Netuna. Everything is foreknown, but free will is given. And those are put out as apparently contradictory, but not. Hey, Bob, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. 866-34-TRUTH. We go to Antonio in California. What's on your mind?
Hi, Mr. Brown. Sorry. Hi, Dr. Brown. I wanted to ask you, basically, how does a biblical Christian combat these mainline Protestant churches in the more Western world that start blessing, say, same-sex marriage, that support like the LGBTQ rights and social justice, like what you see on the news in like a secular sense?
Yeah, Antonio, we recognize that it is part of their larger apostasy from the Bible, that these, quote, mainstream denominations are getting smaller and smaller, losing members more and more because they're departing from real encounter with God and holding to scriptural authority. So almost always when they shift left, they go from pro-life to pro-abortion. They go from pro-family to pro-LGBT activism. They go from pro-Israel to being so pro-Palestinian they become anti-Israel. To me, it's a shift away from scriptural authority, and it is a misguided compassion. In other words, in their minds, they're doing what Jesus would do. Who did Jesus reach out to? The marginalized, the ones that were the sinners, the ones that no one else accepted. And they look at him a certain way and think that they are doing the Christ-like thing. Here, just look at it like this, okay? Here's a lesbian couple. They were attending an evangelical church. They go to enroll their daughter in the Christian school there, right? So it's, you know, the biological daughter of one of them, the others raised them. Okay. They go to enroll their daughter in the church school, and they say, I'm sorry, we can't have her here because we only have marriages that we believe are valid in God's sight, and I'm sorry, we can't have her. Well, they're going to feel it's a total slap in the face. They're going to take it as a personal insult. They're going to feel it's a rejection of their daughter. And now they go to some mainline Methodist church that's gone apostate, yeah, or Presbyterian.
Or Episcopalian.
Episcopalian, yeah, absolutely. And they go over there, and the people say, that's so terrible. That is so unchristian. Who would reject your precious daughter? Who would reject you? You're such sweet women, and you're trying to. So that's how they're looking at it. In other words, I understand that they feel they're doing a righteous thing. They feel they're doing a compassionate thing. They're telling this gay couple, you know, the guy is a great teacher of the Bible, you know, and he's committed to his partner. And why can't we embrace, you know, we should be embracing someone like that, and so on and so forth. So what it is, it's a misguided compassion. So I pity the churches that do this. I warn them. Yeah. But I understand what's motivating. Now, some it's just out and out rebellion. You know what I'm saying? It's like cast off restraint. Anything goes. We believe in the sexual revolution. The Bible, as we interpret it, is old-fashioned. That's more the extreme liberal kind of mentality. But yeah, it's just like when young people, Antonio, and I got to run. I got a break here and then bring in a guest on. But a lot of young people are so passionate for social justice. And they look at Billy and Bobby, they're 17 years old, and the other boys make fun of them because Billy and Bobby want to get married. And so, well, like, they're such nice kids. Why can't they get married? And maybe these kids themselves come from divorced homes, and they don't even know what a good marriage looks like. In their mind, they're doing the right thing. They don't look at the larger issues and the purpose of marriage and what it is in God's sight and so on and so forth. The same way with a lot of these churches that lean left, it's a misguided compassion. Hey, thanks for calling, Antonio, and I hope you're part of a church that stands for righteousness the way God intends it. That's the best compassion. Change the world.
glory.
God of light, hear our cry, send the fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I am delighted to be joined now by Ben Howe, whose hot off the press, already best-selling book is going to be our topic, The Immoral Majority, Why Evangelicals Chose Political Power Over Christian Values. Now, I'm holding the book in my hand, sent to us by the publisher who suggested we have Ben on as a guest. But before I knew this book was coming, I had ordered it and was reading it already. A friend of mine who is a strident opponent of President Trump, but a committed evangelical, wanted me to read it. So I have jumped right in and really looking forward now to this conversation with Ben Howe. Ben, thanks so much for joining us on the Line of Fire.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And I've crossed paths a bit with your uncle and your dad over at Southern Evangelical Seminary type settings.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And as I was reading the book, saw you quoted me a couple of times. I thought, all right, so you're living in a similar world. So Ben, I have endless conversations with folks about this. My wife, Nancy, with great reluctance, voted for President Trump in 2016, but has said she can't do it again in 2020. Might just sit out the election then. In your mind, sir, the subtitle, Why Evangelicals Chose Political Power Over Christian Values, is that what you believe has happened across the board, just with leaders? How deep is this in your view?
I'd say it is a growing problem amongst congregants and a fairly influential portion of congregants. But I would say the leadership is the primary issue. And I was fortunate to grow up in the home I grew up in because I don't have the theological training that like you or my uncle or my dad has. But I did grow up with and around those people. And so theology was just part of my life growing up, apologetics, all of it. And I think it's the responsibility of leaders in the church to not just teach theology as part of what they do in their sermons, but to garner not only interest, but a feeling of responsibility to understand those things. Because to me, salvation is very, very easy to understand to the point that children can understand it, and that's great. But if you're going to go out in the world and witness on the behalf of God, you need to know more, and you need to study, and you need to try to figure it out. And I certainly don't have all the answers, but I think one of my biggest issues these days is that there are a lot of people who seem to think they do have all the answers.
Got it. Now, I have guests on all the time, and not only folks I know that have written books, and I'm familiar with the content, but I don't normally buy a book first and start reading it as I did this time. But, I mean, you are speaking to issue. No, I got it here. These are issues. What you're writing about is what my wife and I talk about every day. What I talk about on the radio a lot and writing normally 4 or 5 op-eds a week, I'm often addressing these kinds of issues. All right. So let's just put things on the table. Again, I'm speaking with Ben Howe, the brand new book, The Immoral Majority. Whether you're a Trump voter, whether you never vote for Trump, this is a book that you'll want to read, especially if you're an evangelical. What if someone said, look, you are a never Trumper. You have a problem with the fact you got in the White House. You don't recognize the incredible good he's done. So fine, he says stupid things and he puts his foot in his mouth and he alienates people. But come on, we're dealing with existential threats to America, to Israel, and Trump is a champion. Just admit it, sour grapes. What would you say to that?
Well, the first thing I'd say is the book and my objections and everything else, as of today, in 2016, when there was a campaign and there was a consideration about who we were going to choose, it was most certainly about Donald Trump and who Donald Trump is and how he is. But in the years since, and especially among evangelicals and most especially among those most vocal leaders, it is primarily about the way that they approach his presidency. Mm-hmm. And what it's revealed to me about the nature of partisanship being wrapped up in faith, because we've reached a point, and Donald Trump exemplifies this, I think, in a lot of ways, because it creates a greater cognitive dissonance, where in order to embrace the things he does, you have to make more and more excuses for him, more than say, George W. Bush. And it's created this image of a faith, my faith, as nothing more than a tool of republicanism. And I don't think republicanism or conservatism, I mean, I'm a conservative. These things in and of themselves as political matters, there's plenty of debate and pragmatism to be had. But when you make voting a matter of faith, I think you are endangering the kingdom. You're putting people in a position where they're led to believe that their political belief, that they're a progressive or whatever, is preventing them from coming to God, that they have to change their behaviors in order to come to God, because after all, God's a Republican.
All right, so you're concerned about the effect that voting for Trump or being associated with Trump or saying having a Franklin Graham or Robert Jeffress or Jerry Falwell Jr., these voices being very vocally, openly associated with President Trump and almost never in a critical way, always in an affirming way, that then means that is the this is the gospel. And if I'm a white evangelical probably, and I'm talking to you about Jesus, then probably I also believe in Donald Trump on some level, and I've now muddied the waters. So you're concerned about our witness. But what about, and I'm trying to make sure we draw everything out that people understand where
sure.
you're coming from, because these are very important spiritual conversations we have to have. So what if someone says, but look, when it comes to the slaughter of the unborn, that's a matter of faith to me. When it comes to yes. preserving religious liberties, that's a matter of faith to me. So I don't put my trust in the president or the party, but when it comes to voting, those are faith issues to me. And then the same thing, you'll have Christians on the Democrat side, that there are other faith issues to them. So have we mixed faith in politics just too much, or was it wrong to do it in the days of slavery?
No, I think that that having faith, I advise people to let their faith guide their vote. I mean, I think that it's impossible to separate your faith from your vote. But partisanship is different than matters of selecting leadership. Partisanship is a team sport, and in a lot of ways, it's a blood sport. So when a faith is wrapped up in a partisan view, like the conservative view or the Republican view, to the point of 81% of people, or 81% of white evangelicals, rather, supporting this president beyond the vote, supporting the way that he deals with matters, the way that he talks, who he is, and saying that his character doesn't matter, all of those things become so associated with the faith that in order for that group, which comprises 26% of the voting population, or the active voting population, they become so intertwined with that partisanship that it's a team effort. So now Christianity, which was about the kingdom and about getting saved and Jesus and bringing people in, it's now also become about making sure that we don't upset the Republican Party, that we don't upset the president, and that we make sure that we spin things in his favor for those greater concerns you're talking about. Those greater concerns are vital. Like they absolutely not, they don't just matter. They're existential, like you were saying. But God is not bound by a two-party system. He's not bound by an election cycle, certainly. And the nature, because I, you know, part of my background isn't just evangelical. I've been working in Republican politics for years. Part of the nature of politics is that every election is the most important election of your life.
Yep, yep.
And, if we tie our faith and God's work to the election cycle, we're taking something eternal and making it short term. And I don't believe that over the course of history, what has been shown, I mean, we're talking about a book that was written in large part 2000 years ago, and we're still studying it. I think long term was part of the idea. And we can't be locked into every 2 years. We've got to do this urgent thing, no matter the cost, or otherwise God somehow can't fulfill his own work.
Got it. Got it. So
that makes sense?
Makes a lot of sense. Absolutely. I do want to talk about another voting block in a moment, African-American voters, which are like 90%, often that high Democrat, but on average more church-going than white Americans, and often with more conservative family values. So I want to bring that up in a moment. But what if someone said this? The other day I said, if I made a list of 10 ways to change America, on my list, voting would be down towards the bottom. something I do in my list of 10, but way down the list of most important things. But because politics does matter, and people appointed to Supreme Court and federal justice and laws that are going to be passed and wars that we might fight or not fight and so on, and immigration, you know, it's a lot that's going to happen. So I will vote. I will be a responsible citizen. But it's like, I got to weigh this versus this. And okay, I have all these reservations with President Trump, but I think the good will outweigh the bad. And when he does things I don't like, I'll say, hey, I have a problem with that. Would that be troubling? If that was the sentiment of the major evangelical leaders in America and many white evangelicals, if that was the sentiment, would you have written your book?
No, I would not have written my book. Because in my mind, a transactional relationship with a president that in many ways defined what evangelicals had most been associated with prior in recent years, which was the Bill Clinton scandal. If evangelicals were then going to turn around to support this president, I think that the best way to have done it, the most, the one that would have been more free of charges of hypocrisy, would have been to say, we have made this determination based on a few issues that are important to us, and so it is a transactional relationship. And as part of this transactional relationship, we will provide him support. What we want in return is for him to stop doing the things that make it difficult for us to support him. Now, I don't think he would have stopped, but then it would have been on the shoulders of the leaders and the congregants to do what I think I try to do. I don't say the bad things, the good things that he does are bad. I'm glad that the embassy was moved in Israel. I'm glad for a lot of the policies that he's talking about. I don't pretend that those are bad. The problem is that because this is a team effort, you also have to pretend like the bad is good or you're not part of the team.
Got it.
And that gets especially dangerous when you start mixing verse interpretations from the Bible in order to justify your actions, most commonly being, you know, render under Caesar and so on. And even if you could make the argument that they're doing that, you know, render under Caesar, or however Jerry Falwell Jr. believes that he's doing that, that's still definitely not the mission that was described when Jerry Falwell Sr. founded the Moral Majority. The whole concept there was not to pick a party and give it power. The concept was to have influence over the people in Washington to bring a greater character and morality to the Capitol.
Right. And what happened there, and we've got a break, and I so appreciate clarity coming in this discussion. Again, speaking with Ben Howe, the book, The Immoral Majority. Wherever you side on this, I think it's an important read. But interestingly, the Moral Majority, which stood for certain values, in my view, made a mistake of becoming an appendage of the Republican Party. But you're saying they did it for moral purposes, and now we're compromising to somehow accomplish something moral. That's the challenge.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I'm speaking with Ben Howe. He's the author of The Immoral Majority, Why Evangelicals Chose Political Power Over Christian Values. Ben, let me ask you this. The extreme left media, which is bashing evangelicals standing with Trump, was bashing evangelicals before this. And I don't believe that if I suddenly shifted and said I won't vote for Donald Trump in the next election, that they'd say, oh, please tell us why you oppose same-sex marriage or why you oppose abortion. You know, I'm still going to be the enemy.
Sure.
Are you succumbing to the spirit
of the
age?
They definitely still treat me that way, just to be clear.
Okay, interesting. So you haven't – I mean, the surefire way to become a real celebrity in the secular world is to have some notoriety and then write a book that there's no hell. And then that's – or at Easter, write a book that there's no resurrection. Then you're like the cool guy for a little while.
Right. So now Jesus doesn't want you to vote for Trump.
Oh, okay. Interesting. So you're saying that you're not getting a warm reception – from the liberal media that's looking to you as now the champion of the cause?
No, it's not that I have not gotten a warm welcome. I definitely, like, they've been very nice. They've been very gracious. And by the way, that's been that way since 2016, when it first came out, Never Trump. The issue is, and I confronted this at the time, you know, I'm going on a lot of shows and I was being told, you're being used. You're being used. They have a narrative and you're helping them fulfill that narrative. And, you know, I feel like I got a great lesson from Billy Graham on this. When he went to the Soviet Union a couple decades ago, he spoke to a huge congregation of Russians, and the sort of the same criticism. The idea was, look, they're using this as propaganda to make the case that they're not anti-Christianity and not anti-religious, and they're using you for that purpose. Why are you helping them fulfill this propaganda? And he said something, I'm paraphrasing, along the lines of, that may be true, I don't know if that's true, but if there was one KGB agent there who had that intent, who needed to hear what I had to say that day, then it was worth it.
Right.
And I try to keep that kind of mentality in mind, which is I can only be used if I'm lying. I'm not lying. I'm saying what I believe. And I think that it's in some ways an olive branch to people who may have previously thought of me as an enemy. And it's also a plea to people that I have always been allies with who are now uncertain about me to like have a conversation. So, yes, they will use me for those purposes. But ultimately, it doesn't matter to me.
Right. Understood. In George Whitefield, famous preacher in England, America in the 1700s, in the days of Protestants being very anti-Catholic, said if the Pope gave him his pulpit, he'd preach from it. So that would be the equivalent of you being on MSNBC or CNN today in a secular setting. Okay,
By the way, I think it's important to do that. I think it's important to do that.
Oh, yeah, I would do it every day if I had the opportunity. It just I'm often not welcome. But in point of fact, as I'm just glancing up, we do a live stream on Facebook and YouTube, and I'm looking at comments. They're loving you and they're hating you. You're wise and you're ignorant. So obviously we're doing what we want to do, which is put these issues out here. Obviously you quote a lot of people in the book, so you're not necessarily going to remember when you quoted me. But I'm quoted first as someone who had real issues with Donald Trump. I strongly opposed him during the primaries, but I kept saying, if it's him versus Hillary, then I'll reevaluate. Yep. But I never thought it would get to that point. I had friends of mine, Lance Wallnau being one with the Cyrus Word and another young man, Jeremiah Johnson. They said the strangest thing, you know, it just seems like something's up with Trump, the most unlikely character. We could never imagine it, but we think he's going to be the president. And then an evangelical leader who hotly opposed him, he doesn't endorse anyone, but was trying to talk like Ben Carson and Mike Huckabee out of standing with Trump. He called me and said, Mike, I think something's going on here. I mean, he's such an unlikely guy with so much baggage. I think something's going on. So I wrote an article when he was elected that I believed it was God did something sovereignly. Now, it could be to expose hypocrisy in the Church of America as well as to stand with Israel. In other words, God could do many things at the same time. But is it to you just happenstance that he became the president, or in an unusual way, might you see God's hand? Now, again, what God does with it, what his purposes are is another question. But could you see that? Go ahead.
I would say broadly, I think it was God's hand when Obama was president.
I understood.
When George W. Bush was president.
Right.
So it's never been a question to me whether or not it is accurate to say that Trump being president is not something that fell outside of the influence of God.
Of course.
My issue is, when we're discussing what God's plans are, which you're not identifying the plan. You're saying it's part of the plan, which clearly it would be, or that's how the plans work. God's in control of them. But you don't know how it'll turn out. My issue is that a lot of people are saying that they do know how it will turn out. And this creates a problem, like Wauno, who you mentioned. He discussed the idea of Cyrus, but not in a, this is comparable way, or maybe he's going to be this. It was very prophetic the way he described it. And my issue with that is when you start pushing sort of these prophetic tomes around this man, you're no longer saying God can use anyone. You're saying God will use this person and the way I think he will. And but I think that's very different from what we're asked to do. I believe what we're asked to do is conduct ourselves biblically in the means and give God the ends. And I don't know how this will end. Trump could very well be this great figure in terms of Christianity that some people have said that he's going to be, this Cyrus-type figure. He could be. But what I won't do is approach that in such a way where I'm trying to protect that possibility by defying God in other ways.
Understood. And to me, this was just, I always understood it as an analogy, a comparison, that just like Cyrus, who was an idol worshiper, was used by God to do Israel good. So Donald Trump, who's clearly an outsider, who's been an immoral man and was obviously not a Christian, God can use him to do good. My big issue is when we have to defend everything or make him into Saint Donald. If the elections were today and it was Donald Trump versus any of the current Democrats, I would almost certainly vote for Donald Trump. My concern is, and it was when I voted, that there's a lot of damage being done because of who he is, because of the nature of national discourse, almost the vulgarizing of the nation. And as long as I can say I differ with that, I have a problem with that, I wish you didn't insult, you know, this one and that one, and now get Denmark, you know, I can vote because of larger issues, but in a context. But real quick, why don't you go after African-Americans, higher Christian population in terms of church attendance than white Americans, and yet overwhelmingly voting Democrat? Aren't they compromising their testimony or the witness of Jesus in the process because they're voting for pro-abortion candidates and all this other stuff? Why aren't they in your crosshairs?
Well, there's a couple of reasons they're not in my crosshairs. The first would be I feel very comfortable discussing and criticizing a movement that I feel I'm from.
Got it.
This movement.
Makes sense.
The second is I haven't abandoned the notion that people vote with their faith in mind without necessarily applying their faith as a matter of partisanship. And I have not seen the polling that indicates that the black community is voting for Democrats to be in line with their religious values. They're mostly in line with Democrats because they feel the Democrat Party better represents their wants as the black community, not a black religious community. And so my concerns about religion and partisanship and voter blocks are these things are all going to exist all the time. But if you tie your faith itself to that outcome and claim that, for instance, the way to be in line with God's wisdom is to pull the lever on a particular party every time, I feel like that is the co-opting of the gospel. I feel like that's taking, it's adding Make America Great Again to the New Testament. And, you know, I love America and I am a patriot. And I really do hope that America, being who we are, can bring great things to the world. But I also know that God doesn't need us, we need him. So if we start looking at ourselves as being vital to the process and that we avoid any of the pitfalls, even if we have to defy him in order to avoid those pitfalls, that's really elevating our own importance to a level that I don't think is biblical.
Got it. So obviously the issue of nationalism taking the place of the kingdom of God or mistaking patriotism for the gospel, while we're loyal American citizens and love our country, we make the distinction, or thinking that somehow electing a particular person is going to bring a country on a course of righteousness, as opposed to an elected official, even a president, has a role which is limited. Yeah, I'm with you on those things. So if the elections were tomorrow and it was Donald Trump as the Republican candidate, let's say Elizabeth Warren was the Democrat candidate, would you sit out the elections? Would you vote a third party? What to you? Or you don't have to answer if that's too personal.
No, it's not too personal.
Would your approach be?
I think it would be similar to what it was in 2016, though. I would have new expectations based on 2016.
Got it.
The first is that, yeah, I would probably find a third party candidate because I do enjoy exercising my freedom to vote, even when I think that that vote may not ultimately play a huge role. What I want is for leaders to step up and earn that vote. And as a conservative, like putting even just my conservative hat on, I was, you know, Tea Party member, all that good stuff. When I just put that hat back on, I think I'm kind of done with voting for somebody because I have to earn it.
Got it. And tell you what, listen, Ben, we are out of time. When the dust settles with the new book, if you ever want to come back on and have a longer discussion, I'd love to do it. Just let your publicist know. The book, The Immoral Majority. Ben Howe, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.